Welcome to the High Performance Half Hour with me, David Osgathorpe. Each week, we meet with athletes, coaches, business owners, and entertainers to discuss the high-performing habits that have led to their individual success. Okay, on this week's show, we have an extremely high-performing individual from the world of sport, a former European gold medalist, Commonwealth bronze, silver, and gold medalist, Olympic silver medalist, and World Championship gold medalist. She was awarded the MBE in 2009 and now is a TV commentator, presenter, TV and radio show panelist, motivational speaker, and mother of two boys. Welcome to the show, Gail Emms.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Listen, there's a pretty impressive list of achievements there. Is there sort of anything that really stands out for you as, you know, the main thing?
I think it's when you sort of list them, and when you were, and you know, sort of during my playing career, they were just jobs for me to do. There were things to tick off the box. So, when I hear them, I just go, yeah, that was my job to do it. So, it's only sort of reflecting back, and you have that time as an athlete, you know, to look back at your journey and talk about how things motivated you, why things motivate you, that you sort of realize the importance of them all. I think the one for me was that really stands out is the Olympic silver medal, because, you know, obviously it's the Olympic Games, and, you know, in my eyes, there's no greater sporting event in the world. It is just iconic. It's, you know, the history behind it. It's something special. And it's once every 4 years as well. So for me, that one, and I think that was my first ever final, like big major final. So I think that really spurred me on to what I wanted to do in the sport, and actually how everything happened after that, really, for me. So I think that one holds amazing memories. Yeah.
So it was like the focus from a sort of young age, but then the trigger for other things going forwards then, really.
Yeah. I mean, so you grow up watching the Olympics, and, you know, it's iconic. I remember watching, I think the first Olympics that had a massive impact on me was 92 Barcelona. And I think, you know, I was 15 years old. I was a sporty girl, and I had all this energy, and I knew that sport was going to be in my life, but I just didn't know what to do with it. And I think watching that, and just thinking, oh, it's a place for sporty people like me, you know, and especially seeing women as well. And I think that's really important for girls. You know, you grow up, and this is back in the day when, you know, obviously I'm showing my age now. So back in the day when we put the TV on, you'd be inundated with football, cricket, rugby. But you wouldn't see many women on TV, not sporty women anyway. And it was the first time I saw female athletes, and Sally Gunnell was the one that really stood out to me. I saw her win her gold medal, and I just thought, it was just such a light bulb moment that, you know, women can be strong, women can be fast, women can achieve. I think that's what really hit home, the emotions of it, the emotions of seeing athletes on a podium and winning that gold medal. It just, yeah, it does do something.
Definitely. So what sports were you playing around about that time?
So I was one of those girls, or one of those boys, that was in every single sports team. You know that one? There's always one, isn't there? They go, oh God, you know, is there a sport they can't do? And that was me. I have been playing badminton since I was about 3 or 4 years old, because my mum and dad play. So that was always in my life, and I didn't really play much badminton at school. But at school it was hockey, netball, swimming, athletics, rounders, tennis, you name it. If they, you know, I think I tried to start a cricket team at school, but only two people turned up. So that was a bit, you know, pointless. It was everything. I just loved it. And it didn't matter what it was. I just wanted to be the best at it. And I think it's great. Didn't get me many friends, that's for sure. You know, you try and beat everyone in your school, you're like, everyone gets really annoyed with you, especially girls as well. They're like, oh my God, Gail, just calm down, stop making everything a competition. I'm like, come on, let's be the first to do this, let's have a race. And everyone's, yeah. So it was just my personality, and you couldn't really be like that in a French lesson, or you couldn't be like that in maths. I could be like that. I was a star in the sports scene. So, it was just my play.
At that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was that always the dream then as a kid, to kind of, you know, pursue a career in sport in some way?
No, because it was not really seemed a career then. Mm. And that's what was really interesting. I was a part of the amateur days going into professionalism. And I think that's why I can see both sides of what's good and what isn't good about professional sport. You know, I remember going into, you know, we used to have the careers teacher and they were like, so Gail, what would you like to do when you're older? And I was like, well, you know what, I've seen the Olympic Games and I'd love to be an Olympian. They were like, yes, but what is your job going to be? You know, that's a hobby. And, you know, and again, a woman athlete was not really seen as a career. So there were, you know, it was a massive push for education. And I'm, you know, and I'm really glad that, you know, my education was being pushed. But yeah, it was, I knew I had to be involved in sport, but I just didn't know what or where. But, you know, this is what you learn. You sort of go on that sort of journey and things happen and you think you're going to go one way, but then something will turn you this way and that way. So I was all set in my eyes at 18 when lottery funding came into effect. So 1995, I left school. National lottery was coming in and everyone was talking about this. Oh, there's going to be money. And if you're kind of deemed good enough, that, you know, the governing bodies are going to support you. So you don't have to work. You can just train full time. And we were like, wow, because this is, you know, I've been, you know, such a burden on your mum and dad, because that's what it is, bank of mum and dad, to try and help you with coaching and, you know, sort of training and equipment. And suddenly, you know, there is this opportunity to get funded. So I remember being called into the office at 18, bearing in mind that I was European junior champion and world junior bronze medalist. And I was very, you know, with Nathan Robertson as well, the same school year. So we went in and, you know, I was all, you know, confident. I was thinking, you know, how much money am I going to get? You know, that kind of attitude. And they turned around to me and went, yeah, Gail, we think it's all Nathan. It's not you. We don't think you're good enough. You're not naturally talented enough.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's the same in lots of other sports, you know, academy football, rugby, cricket. There will be a time, you know, when you will get an opinion. You know, someone, a manager or, you know, performance director will have an opinion on you. And it's exactly the same for me. They told me that I was not going to be, they didn't think I was good enough to be an Olympian or a world champ, go to world championships. There were lots of shots in badminton that I can't do. So, you know, when I say I'm not naturally skillful in terms of badminton, you know, it's actually true. So, yeah, so my dreams of being funded at 18 were kind of ripped up to shreds and I had to have a plan B.
Well, I mean, that sort of, I guess, you know, is... You hear that story so many times with youngsters in sport, and it's kind of like make or break time, really, isn't it? And I think with the ones that aren't maybe quite as tough for characters, they do fall by the wayside at that time. And everyone knows that person with a story of what could have been, whatever. And I guess that, you know, you could have joined that. And I guess that maybe someone not as strong-willed would have kind of given up at that time. But that did that in a way maybe spur you on a bit more?
I walked out of that office and I thought... I wasn't expecting that, but because you respect these people and that, you know, they are very high up and they are, you know, experts in their field or whatever, I accepted what they said. So I did. I went off to university for 3 years and I played a little bit of badminton, but I didn't do much, you know, because in my mind, you know, someone said I wasn't going to make it. So I thought, well, what's the point? But you know what? I had the best 3 years of my life and I met some amazing people. I got drunk. I studied. I got a degree. You know, I lived. And I think I came back after that university and I thought, right, so what am I going to do now? And I had this feeling in my stomach and I had this, you know, nagging voice in my head thinking, you know what, I still love badminton. I just want to see where I am. You know, I'm very aware that I've been, you know, sort of living life, a different life at university, but you know,
are we sort of late 90s about now?
Yes, yeah, so 98. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to give it a go, see where, you know, just give like a level up, see where I am. And I remember playing this tournament. And when I played it, because I heard there was prize money in it and I needed money to pay my rent. So that was the first reason why I played this tournament. I found two rackets. I mean, literally, I had two. And usually you take about 6 or 7 or 8 rackets to an event. I found two. Literally packed about 2 shirts and a pair of shorts and I turned up, rocked up at this tournament. And you know what? I didn't win it, but I did all right. And I thought, my God, you know, I played this just because I needed rent. And I did okay against the girls that have been training professionally with this lottery money. And I thought, ooh. And that's the kind of thing that you need. It's only a little, whether it's a little spark or it's a little, you know, that gate opening or door opening, or you just need something. But you've got to go and find it. When you talk about sort of kids that might have been let down or whatever, it's not easy just going, right, I want to prove you wrong. You need that little opening. And sometimes that opening will come straight away, might come a few years later. But you know what? When you do see that chance, that's the moment. And you see whether they go, no, I don't want to risk rejection again, or, you know what, I'm going to go for this. And that's what I decided. I went, I'm going to do this. And because, you know, I just thought, I've done nothing. I haven't really done anything for 3 years and I've done okay against you. So you know what? Maybe I have got something about me.
Brilliant. Had you had any contact with anyone in the world of badminton during the time at university then?
Yeah, I had, because, you know, they're your mates and everything like that. So, and you know, you sort of keep up to date, oh, who's beaten who and, you know, what's happening. Because Sydney Olympics is happening, you know, coming up. And you know, I'd always had my, as a little girl, because when, you know, when I watched Barcelona, Sydney 2000 was my, oh, maybe one, I could go to Sydney, you know, because I'm doing okay. And that was in my head. So for some, you know, I was always a little bit, oh, Sydney's coming up. And that was then the target. After I did okay at that badminton tournament, you know, sort of keeping in touch with people and seeing where they were. And I thought, well, if they're training for Sydney, I'm going to train for Sydney as well. And then it was like game on.
Amazing. But then was the first sort of major championships, was that in Manchester?
Yeah, Commonwealth Games. So I missed out in Sydney by one place. So wow. I did, you know.
Another little setback there.
Oh, yeah, you know, full of setbacks. I know, I might as well just title this Gale Fail, shouldn't we? It's like, so in badminton, you had to be in the top 16 of the world rankings to make it in the Olympic Games, and I finished 17th.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was a real, real blow. You know what? You know, I had no funding. I worked as a waitress. I worked in the bar all night just to get the money to pay for everything. And you know what? If I did all that and I got so close, you know, part of you just goes, I can't leave it, because what if, you know? And I always said that I never wanted any regrets or anything like that. And I couldn't shut this feeling up watching Sydney on TV. So that's what spurred me on. And the next championships was the Commonwealth Games in Manchester. So I thought, right, you know, I'm training my butt off basically and making sure that this feeling never, ever happens again.
Brilliant. And that went pretty well. Came back with a medal.
Yeah, but I was expected to get 3 golds. So I actually was disappointed. Really? Yeah, I got a gold and a bronze. So another setback. I went into that championship way too cocky. I was expected 3 golds because I'd really upped my training since my disappointment of Sydney, and suddenly people were watching me. I'd lost weight. My body was in brilliant condition. I was fast, strong. You know, people were like, wow. So, you know, I was one to watch, and I walked into that championship thinking I was going to win everything. And that was the biggest learning curve ever. Never, ever go into a major championships thinking you're the bee's knees. That's all I can say.
But look, it's still a win. But then after that, you kind of went back to mixed doubles. Is that right?
Yeah. So I did, but we failed mixed doubles. Myself and Nathan were favourite for the gold medal. And we lost in the quarterfinals of the Commonwealth Games. So that's why, you know, I achieved in ladies doubles. But so I was always playing mixed doubles, and it was always my favourite event. But, you know, again, setback spurred me on. Don't ever do that again. So that was the focus for Athens, basically. It was all about the mixed doubles.
Yeah. And it's that. So again, that time, so between like 2002, 2004, was that when you were sort of really sort of super focused, loving your playing, loving your training, kind of really enjoying things there? Or was your sort of mindset like at that time?
Definitely. I think because I hadn't been to an Olympic Games before, I had my just, you know, the glitter and the glamour of the Olympic Games is always in my mind. You know, everything was a bit more of a fairy tale. I was living the dream. I was traveling the world, going to countries, all around the Far East. It was just brilliant. And I was winning. So when everything's like that, I was loving life. It was just, I don't remember anything being unhappy about that moment. So wake up, love training. My body was in great form. Just everything.
What was a normal day of sort of training like for you at that time then?
So badminton players train 3 times a day, 6 days a week. So we would in the mornings train 8 till 9 on all like rehab stuff and prehab. So a lot of getting our bodies ready for the day. So a lot of TheraBand work, core stability work. Then we'd be on court from 9 to 11. And then, literally on court, like the coaches would be whacking shuttles about and we just have to go and get them back. So we were really, really pushed hard in those 2 hours. There was not much rest. It was just relentless. Then we'd have a break, bit of lunch, quick power nap. Then in the afternoon, we'd do a physical session. So 3 days a week, it would be weights. And for badminton players, it's all of the legs. So we couldn't bulk too much on our upper body because we needed that for speed. It was all like squats, lunges, that sort of stuff. I mean, I used to squat 130 kilos, so double my body weight. Standing jumps of about 90 centimeters. It was just all about that plyometric and power. And then we do CV 3 times a week as well, so interval runs and everything like that. Then we'd be back on court doing more of a skill session, like probably about 3 till 4, doing more of a skill, or 3 till 5, yeah, lots more technical stuff. Then we do the ice baths and the massage and everything like that with some analysis of our day and player analysis. So, yeah, then literally get back home, eat loads of pasta and then just collapse in bed, basically. Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. And that was, so we're talking like full 2-year kind of cycle there. Well obviously yeah. Olympics cycle being 4 years, but from that time, that 2002 up till 2004, every day was pretty much the same like that, was it?
Oh, yes. And, bearing in mind that badminton is in a green sports hall. So, yeah, stinky, sweaty, in the summer and then freezing cold in the winter. So, yeah, loving it. Love the colour green now.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Enjoy. So, what sort of kept you in that frame of mind then? What I kind of want to do with this show is kind of get into the mindsets of people. Were there certain behaviors and certain little routines that you had? Were you quite sort of very precise with your planning for the day? And were there sort of weird and wonderful little routines that you had to kind of keep you on track?
So I was never really a strategy person, or I never planned anything specific. For me, it's all about the feeling. So the reason why I got out of bed when I really, really didn't want to get out of bed, the reason why I pushed myself when I really, really didn't want to, is because I am stubborn as hell. And I thought, if I do not do this, I am not going to achieve. And I hate losing. I really hate losing. And I don't train because I love training. I train because I love winning. And I wanted to be the best. I had, I am not going to give up. I have, my whole life has been about, sort of proving people wrong or whatever. And I just wanted to kind of show that I can do this. I can push myself. And then, I thought, if I'm not doing it, my opponents are doing it. If I'm not pushing myself as far as I can on that interval run, my opponents will be. And I need to be faster, because I was lacking in that skill side as well. Because I hadn't got every single shot in the book, I knew I had to push myself on the physical side.
Well, again, you're really tough on yourself. I like this. It's kind of you sort of saying that, you weren't the most skillful player, but you wanted to kind of outwork people, yeah?
Yeah. And I think this is something that, I'm very open about, and people go, no, you were really talented. I was like, no, don't get me wrong. I could obviously hit the shuttle. I'm not saying I couldn't hit the shuttle. It's just that if you line all the players up and so all the girls up, and if you said, right, who's the, when I'm talking about like a Roger Federer, smooth, silky kind of the way they can, hit that shuttle beautifully, right? They would be at the one end. I would say they're the natural talent. And that's someone like Nathan Robertson, my partner. He is just incredible like that. And then you get the ones that are a bit more of, you know, the ones that are a bit like, they just whack it really hard. There's not much, you know, like style. There's not much, you know, but you know what? They do the job. And that's kind of that the other side of the scale. And that's more me. Now, I'm actually quite proud of it. I'm not saying that I didn't practice my skill or I didn't practice it. I just, you know, thought, well, I work hard. And you know what? It's really hard to beat people that are really stubborn. And if I can make myself really, really strong in all the other areas, so what if my backhand's not as good as my forehand? I am so fast, I'm going to run around so quick that they can't even hit it on my backhand because I'm so fast. And, you know, all those little things, all these little delicate shots that people go, oh, you can't see a backhand cross-court net shot. Then you know what? No, I can't, but I can smack it really hard. So there you go. And I think it's that kind of turning it. Sometimes we're so focused on sports people, you know, then really weak left foot. You're like, well, you know what? Their right foot's blooming amazing. So you know, sometimes let's celebrate that. And as long as you're aware of it and it's okay, because no one's perfect. And no one's the perfect businessman. No one's the perfect parent. No one's the perfect person. But you know what? If you know your strengths and weaknesses and are okay with it, and you just sort of really do all the good things really, really well, and you're kind of aware of your weaknesses, but it's okay and practice when you can, there you go. That's all you can do.
I think that's really powerful. Is this you talking now with hindsight? Or were you your toughest critic at the time?
I was at this stage. So you're talking about just before Olympics, so 2004, I was really I was tough on myself. I hadn't quite fully accepted this yet. I knew it, but I hadn't accepted it. Because, you know, I was still learning, you know, I wasn't mature in those finals and big major championships. So I was still trying to show people what I was about. I was still a bit of a new kid on the block, you know, a bit of a late bloomer. So people were still trying to criticize me a little bit. So yeah, I was still quite a critic on myself here. But
yeah, there we are. You come away with a silver medal in the Olympics. I mean, that's just amazing. I've seen some nice little videos. I think your family there and all of that. It's quite emotional kind of stuff, I'm sure. You know, is it one of those things that you watch back with a nice sort of proud tears in your eyes and that kind of thing?
Nope, I haven't watched it ever.
Have you not really? No. Wow.
Why do you think I haven't watched it?
Because you lost ultimately.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I can't watch it.
All right. Well,
I lose. I don't want to watch myself losing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we go from there.
Yeah.
Until 2006 in Madrid.
Yes.
And you did win. So have you watched this one back again?
Oh yeah, I watch that every day. It's not even a great match, but I don't care. Yeah, I do watch it. The ones that I win, because yeah, you're right. It's that silver. It was horrible in a good way and a bad way. Because you know, I said at the start, that was what spurred me on. Because I stood on the podium in silver medal position and I hated it. I wanted to be on that gold medal position. And the reason why I hated it is because I knew I could be better. I think if I'd have stood in that silver medal position and, you know, I played amazing and I couldn't have done any more and all that, I would have been, you know, maybe I could watch the final back. But I stood there and thought, I can still get better. This is just a start. So when I got into the gold medal position in world championships and, you know, great feeling, number one in the world, recommend it. You know, you sort of stand there and you go, now I get it. This is good. This is when I can relax. I felt like a relief and I felt this, you know, this is what I was supposed to do, you know, and that's kind of the difference between a silver and a gold. So yeah, really much I felt, you know, job done, very, very, you know, that's it. I can kind of, not that I wanted to stick two fingers up to people, you know, who doubted me, but it was like, it kind of just shuts the critics up, which was a very nice feeling.
Definitely. But in a way, was that almost like the beginning of the end of the sort of love affair with badminton, in a way?
Totally. It's weird, isn't it? Because you expect people, I think that I had this massive kind of you know, so, oh, you must have been partying, so happy and so excited, and I just went, no, it was job done, And then suddenly it was like, oh my God, you know, I'm 29 years old, got two more years for another Olympic cycle. I'm world number one. Everyone wants to beat me. And then suddenly, you know, physically, I'm very, very naturally strong, very naturally fit. So that wasn't the problem. I could carry on the physical side, but the mental side was getting to me. And it was mentally the traveling, mental battle of, you know, beating people. You know, I am in awe of, you know, people like Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, their ability to beat people continuously. You know, that is incredible.
It's one thing to get to the top and it's another thing staying there, isn't it?
God, yeah. And I'm quite an emotional person, so I'm quite up and down. I'm more of an Andy Murray, let's say, than I am a Djokovic or a Federer, who are, you know, just these animals that being able to beat people over and over again. And for me, sometimes it wore me out completely. And I still don't know why. I'm still sort of don't understand, because I'm mentally tough on the court, but it was everything else around it that was just getting to me. And maybe I was just beginning to see the bigger picture. Maybe I was beginning to question, you know, what else is there in the world? Maybe I was just growing up. Maybe I was maturing. Whatever. I don't know. It was just.
So did you feel like you needed to make that call that the Olympics, that was going to be it, that was going to be curtain down after that, and then you move on to the next stage in your life?
Definitely. And I think that I remember sitting in that green sports hall, and I'd had an okay day training, but I just was like, I sat there and went, I've got two more years of this and then I'm done. And I, you know, my coach was quite shocked. He was like, oh yeah, girl, whatever. And I went, no, I've had enough. But, you know, I'm like, what is this, my life hitting shuttlecocks over a net? And, you know, it's just that kind of, we all have those moments, don't we? We're like, what am I doing with my life? And I think that was it. And, you know, I just, yeah, it was, you know, I knew I didn't love it. It was a job. It became a job. It wasn't my passion. And it's horrible because it happens to every sports person at some stage. And when it does hit, it kind of, it's like, oh, yeah.
Well, it's a piece of you. It's been, you know, such a big part of your life. Mm. And then it's coming to terms with, I think you kind of, you know, I love that analogy when you say that you play sport, but when it doesn't become play, it just becomes work.
Mm.
It's a challenging kind of time, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's forgetting the reason. What happens when you get when a passion of yours becomes your job? It can get very, your the reasons for why you did it and those emotions about being having it as a passion often get forgotten about. And I think that's why I really love, you know, reflective practice now. So whether it's business coaching or mentoring, just helping people stop and kind of take a few moments and go, oh yeah, this is why I do it. This is why I love doing what I'm doing. Because we get so, today's society, maybe not down in lockdown at the moment, but in today's society, we are so on this conveyor belt and these, you know, we've got these blinkers on and I'm going to achieve this and this is the track I'm going on. And we go 100 miles an hour down this one road. And, you know, sometimes we just need to stop and go, okay, so why are you doing this? Why? And, you know, what are the reasons? Who are the people? You know, and you forget about the people that got you involved. And, you know, sometimes I think back and I think how, as an athlete, how horrible I was. And I, you know, you sort of get into this survival mode and I was quite a bitch and, you know, quite standoffish. And, you know, and I remember sort of talking to someone after I retired, you know, sort of a few years after I retired, and he just went, that's the first time you've ever asked me how I was. And I went,
wow.
Yeah, whoa, I'm so sorry. And he goes, you know, we get it, you know, you as an athlete, and this is why athletes come across, you know, arrogant and because it's just a mask, it's a survival thing, because we just are so in this zone, we don't know how else to be, because we are on this one road of I must win and must win. And yet no one has stopped us to start and, you know, ask us, who are the people who got you involved? And, you know, talk to me about that, your first coach, or when did you first play sport? Can you remember your emotions when you, your first ever win or anything like that? We forget that, we become robots, and, you know, this is what I don't want to happen in today's society with all the money and pressures involved in sport now, because it is a business. So many athletes are becoming more and more robotic, going on this conveyor belt and then getting chucked off, and we're not, what's the point, you know? And we could get better athletes out of, you know, out of these guys by just these simple little things. And like I say, in work as well, you know, people are so, I must achieve this by this time, and I'm on achieved, you know, get to CEO, whatever. And then sometimes actually, you know, stopping, going, why? What can you do differently? All these little questioning tools can be very, very powerful.
I think you hit the nail on the head. There's so much. And I think a lot of the time, you know, we're just in, you know, in our own little zone and in our own little head, and we've got our goal and the next goal and the next goal and the next goal. And it's never kind of stopping to even really properly celebrate those wins. I'm sure with you, you have one night, you go, yep, great. And then you're back to work kind of thing. And I think it's patting yourself on the back. And like you said, actually having that ability to just step away. Go, how do I feel about this and why? And what you've touched upon there is, you know, something that I wanted to kind of bring up in on here with a project that you're kind of working on now, which obviously we talked a little bit around mental health, and you've obviously openly discussed a few issues that you had yourself with mental health after leaving the sport, and you've kind of set up this sport mental group for athletes at the moment. Do you want to kind of tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, it's a real passion of mine. You can see that, and hopefully it comes across that I've gone on a bit of a journey. You know, it's okay. I'm okay to talk about it now, but it's been, you know, I've been retired for 11 years now, and it's been a hard process. Transition for athletes is tough. It is really, really tough. It's like grieving your identity. It's complete change of mental process and thought, and it's horrible, and it's horrible, horrible, horrible. And I've had, you know, sort of lots of work with therapists and counselors and mentors as well to help me get to where I am now, because I did suffer. I suffered from depression, anxiety, and, you know, it's something I'm still, you know, sometimes I still have battles with about, you know, when you've grown up in sport and you know what you have to do, and suddenly now I'm in real world, and I'm like, oh, you realize that sport is a bubble. Sport is not real life, and the real world works completely differently, and it's a huge shock. And in the times, my really dark times, I don't want any athlete to feel like how I felt. And this is why, you know, all these little things, they're not massive things, that can be easily done in coaching, you know, that I just want to get away from this winning at all costs mentality, that actually treating athletes as people will actually help them as athletes. They'll be better athletes, and they'll have a better transition, because we know who the person is, and they're not just a footballer or a badminton player. They are someone, they have got a name, and they've got other interests and other passions in their life. The trouble is what, you know, this is what I've seen from going from the amateur to professional and what's happening right now. I don't want any athlete to look back and hate their sporting career. They should look back with pride. And unfortunately, with, you know, whether it's being dropped from, you know, teams or their, you know, a bad injury, sometimes the athletes can look back and just, you know, hate, or, you know, look back with disappointment or, you know, actually feel quite bitter about what's happened. So there's a group of ex-athletes that we kind of see them on, you know, sort of various golfing events and various lunches and charity lunches. And there was a footballer called Lee Hendry, who obviously Aston Villa legend, he's played for England as well. He has gone through some real mental health problems as well. And we were just chatting about this. And we always said that we wanted to kind of set up a group, because athletes get it. You know, sometimes I can talk to Lee about stuff that I can't talk about anyone else, because Lee knows what it's like, because he knew exactly that adrenaline rush, the feeling of, you know, lack of identity, all these little things that athletes really get. And we were talking about trying to get this group together where we can have this open chat about stuff and feel really, you know, feel part of something. It's not about, you know, sort of a cry for, you know, we're not clinical psychologists, or we're not a therapist or counsellors, but if people need that, we can help them with that, you know, support. We were planning on doing this at the end of the year, but then of course the coronavirus situation hits, and we looked at each other, we just went, we need to set something up now, because sport, you know, this sport will not be the same for quite a while. And there are many athletes who, athletes love control. They love control so much. They control the controllables. They control what they want to do, and they control their planning, and they control the training and everything like that. It's all about control. And suddenly it's all gone crazy and no one knows what's going to happen. And that is the worst thing for an athlete. You're training, but you don't know what you're training for, or when, or how, or what. And you're kind of on your own, and you're so used to having a team of people around you. And I can tell you now, there are so many athletes that are going completely bonkers right now. And I know, you know, sort of obviously the bigger picture and, you know, all that. But what we did was just trying to kind of get that awareness out there that, you know what, everyone's in the same situation. We're in this together. So Lee and I set this sport mental group up just to kind of say, look, you know, let's get together, just chat. You know, if you're feeling a little bit rubbish, you want to rant, you want to talk about anything other than sport, it's okay, because we know exactly how we feel, because there's a whole load of us exactly the same. And, you know, it is about support. We need people, need people. And then say, whether it's a, you know, sort of in different industries or whatever, it's just trying to get people to talk. In sport, we're trying, you know, we're so trying to be like gladiators and, you know, like these big tough people and, you know, oh yeah, we can take on the world. But we're human. We're just like everyone else. And it's just encouraging.
I think it's really powerful, because often the people that you think you can talk to, the family, the friends, the coaches, the managers, mm-hmm. are actually some of the worst people to yeah. speak to at that time, because yeah. there's too much judgment around there, or they're too invested in things and they're looking at it from their perspective. And so actually having that safe place
yeah.
for them must be really powerful.
And it's that trust. You've got it spot on. That a lot of clubs will go, it's okay, we've got a sports psychologist. And I went, yeah, but a sports psychologist has a duty to report to somebody else. And, yeah. you know, where is that line? Because that line gets blurred a lot. And that's why we just want, you know, someone's just feeling a little bit down, or, you know, just want to go, oh, you know what, my family doing my head in, or, you know, whatever. This is what it's for. So you don't have to go, you don't have to worry about that trust. And that is all it is. It's that balance between fear and trust, which athletes battle with every day. Do they feel good? Do they trust themselves? Do they trust their team? Do they trust the process? Or are they fearful of themselves, fearful of the outcome, fear? And if they fear, they don't perform. So that's what we just want to take away, just that, you know, just want to say, it's okay. You know, we're in this together.
I really like that. You shared that concept with me before, the fear and the trust thing. I really, really like that. I think you can kind of just transfer that across to any part of life, really, and sport. It's, you know, yeah, trusting yourself, trusting in the people around you, or being fearful of your own actions and those people around you. And it just changes everything, doesn't it?
And we all need it. We need both. You know, we can't eliminate fear. We need that. That's a bit of insecurity, because that's what drives us, you know, just gets us out of bed, or, you know, sort of gets us working, or, you know, sort of get right, come on, let's go on this project, whatever. We need that fear. But it's when your own personal balance is out of balance, and that's, again, reflective practice. You know, everyone's balance is different. Some people like a little bit more fear than others. And but if you don't stop and know how you work, how do you know if you are in balance or not? And this is where the whole mental health, you know, we don't stop and go, okay, so physically, maybe I can lose a bit of weight, or maybe I want to get fitter, or I've got goals, you know, to run a 10K or something. But do we stop and look at ourselves, do a mental health check? Am I okay? Am I feeling too fearful? Am I feeling too anxious? Am I worried? Or do I trust? Am I feeling good? Do I trust the process? Do I trust that I'm on the right tracks? You know, even little things like that. But if you can't do that unless you stop and reflect.
This is really powerful. It'd be really interesting to know, you know, how many athletes, you know, that you can get on board with this, and potentially how many kind of teams actually incorporate this type of thing in there. Or, like you said, is it appropriate? Is it something that someone out on the outside needs to be involved in, just to kind of create that safe space?
I think it'll be an outside thing, and that's okay. You know, we're not trying to like I say, Lee and I aren't trying to take people's positions in the club or in a club or a team. It's not like that. It is purely, and it's purely, yeah, I just want to, you know, I can't keep using that word, support. You know, it's nothing else that, you know, we haven't got agendas. I'm not going to start going up to managers and coaches going, you're treating like this person wrong. It is just to know, it's just powerful for athletes to know that this, yeah, it's okay to talk.
So is this sort of the new kind of purpose for you personally at the moment then?
Yeah. And I had a really bad blip in 2017. And I had a really, really horrible time. And I didn't know, and it's weird because, you know, we talk about sort of moments in life, I guess, that, you know, you change track. And I never, ever thought this would be where I was going to go or do with my life. But the response I got from that blip, big blip, horrible blip, was just like, well, maybe I was supposed to go through that to understand more of this side and then to know that this is something that I can do. So I think the more I talk about it, the more people talk to me about it, I can't let this go, you know. I feel it's a responsibility and a bit of a, I feel, you know, sort of a duty to make sure that, like I say, I feel, I don't want anyone to feel the way I did. So if I can, if by doing this, if I can help in any way, then I guess this is where I'm going to end up in life. And you know what? I love it. So yeah, this is my new passion.
Yeah. Which is kind of where we started things off, wasn't it? In terms of, you know, having that passion that drove you on to kind of, you know, and until it sort of became work and you lost the passion in a way, to have a new focus with that passion in you, like you said, that's what you thrive on, that's who you are as a person. It's great to kind of find something, and if you had to go through some crappy times yourself to kind of get there, then it sort of makes that message so much more powerful and makes, you know, your work in this area so much more powerful.
I've always said it's all about circles. I think in life we're too much on one line pathways, you know, these diagonal lines, you know, going upwards, trajectory upwards, and they're, you know, got to stay on this track. If not, then you're chucked off, you know, it's conveyor belts of it. And actually sometimes we need to draw circles, so connecting everything together. And when you have that connection of everything, that everything was a reason for something else, and you keep, and these beautiful circles appear, do you know what, it actually feels really good. There are not enough circles in life.
That's amazing. Listen, Gail, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed you sharing that story today. Really inspiring on so many levels. And you know, hopefully we can do this again sometime.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, man.